It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Later in the program, it's been 1 year since the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program went into effect, allowing children of immigrants a chance to stay in the country. We'll take a look at how the program's been working. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
But first, we look at new statistics just released from the ACT testing company. Only one quarter of this year's high school graduates who took the ACT have the reading, math, English, and science skills they need to succeed in college or in a career.
Add that to the fact that the 2013 ACT scores are the lowest they've been in 5 years, with the biggest drops occurring in the English and reading sections. So what does that say about the state of education in the United States?
Joining us now to help us understand is Scott Jasek. He's editor at Inside Higher Ed. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, only one quarter of high school seniors who took the ACT test this year had scores high enough to be considered ready for college or the workforce. What is your reaction to this?
Well, it's a direct reflection of the fact that they're not taking the right courses in high school. The ACT and also the College Board for the SAT have consistently shown that students who take college preparatory courses do better. And the fact is, a lot of students aren't taking the right courses. They're taking the non-college prep courses, which may be easier, but are unlikely to be preparing them.
But isn't the ACT designed to assess one's competence in these areas? After just graduating standard high school courses, why is college preparatory part of the fold?
Well, I mean, it assesses you regardless of what courses you took.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is they want you to have the college preparatory courses. You will do better. And the reality is these college preparatory courses are also more rigorous and will help people who are preparing for a range of future plans, not just going to the university, but maybe going to community college. The reality is that students today generally need some post-secondary education and may not want to close off their options.
Well, how does the ATC gauge readiness? I'm going to leave it at that.
So there are two things. They're looking at the test scores, which are designed to predict success in college, and those are down slightly this year. But then they look at whether students have met benchmarks in terms of completing courses with a B, completing courses with a good grade that should suggest that they would have 50% chance of earning a B or better in college. And so they're looking, did they take the courses? Only 26% met all four subject benchmarks, so English, reading, mathematics, and science. 31% of students did not meet a single benchmark.
What accounts for that, especially if we break it down into demographics?
Well, if you look at demographics, you see, this year is no different from recent years, very wide variation by race and ethnicity. So if you look at the composite score, which is based on all parts of the ACT, the Asian score was 23.5 this year, white 22.2, Hispanic 18.8, African American 16.9. And if you look at this over 5 years, while there have been some slight variation, they're basically those gaps remain stable. Now, I also think you have to look at where people are going to high school, the kinds of opportunities they have, and whether they're getting the kind of advising that puts them into the college track, into the more rigorous courses. Unfortunately, many minority students aren't given the same opportunities.
Well, whose responsibility is that? Should teachers be more rigorous about teaching these subjects? Should counselors be more proactive about encouraging students to take those college preparatory courses? Or should the students own this?
I think it's some of everything. And you also left out the parents, who I would very much include. Students need better counseling. People need to tell them that there are consequences to not taking the more rigorous courses. People need to tell them that the easier path may not lead to the right options, down the road. Teachers are teaching these courses, but many high schools, particularly in low-income areas, don't have enough counselors to provide individual attention. And then certainly students do need to be making better choices, and their parents need to be encouraging them to make better choices. But the kinds of information that we're talking about here, that if you take college preparatory courses, you'll do better both on the ACT and in life, it's not a state secret. They've been saying this, educators have been saying this for some time. So I do think you need to look at the kinds of advice students are getting and the kinds of commitments that families have to making sure their kids get the right information.
So let me ask you this, as someone who hasn't taken the ACT for a very long time, in terms of how it gauges one's readiness for the world, I think back to when I took it, and I remember a lot of trigonometry-type questions, reading comprehension. I can see how, for example, reading comprehension will apply itself in the real world, even if I don't go to college. But what about things like math, trigonometry, those types of things?
Well, I think today, almost regardless of your career, understanding some math, some science is essential just to be an informed citizen and to work in any number of fields. They're not testing your knowledge of college-level advanced calculus. These are things that for many opportunities you need to have. Now, we can all point to elements of our high school education that we don't feel that we use, but it's important to remember that when you go off to college, you may not know if you're a future radio broadcaster or pre-med. The problem with students not getting the preparation is it is closing off opportunities. And I think if you look back even into the middle schools, students who get tracked off the college prep track don't have the chance later to say, you know what, I'm becoming a more serious student, I'm a late bloomer, I'm becoming interested in something. Do we really want people losing options in the middle of high school because they're not taking the tougher courses?
Mm-hmm. So how concerned should we be about this trend, especially as we hear arguments, even on the show in some cases, from guests and others, callers even, who say that in this new economy, college is just kind of out of reach, and I'm going to have to find something else to do that doesn't involve a 2 or 4 year education?
Well, first of all, I think that particularly if you include 2 year education, 2 year education is not out of reach. And the right program probably exists and probably isn't that expensive. I worry that a lot of people hear what the most expensive colleges cost and their sticker price and think they can't afford anything. The question is, if you look at professions, even what were once called traditional blue-collar professions, the people who are succeeding them today probably have a community college certificate or an associate degree. So the idea that you can advance economically with just a high school diploma, there's really just not evidence for that. Even in the recent economic downturn, people with associate degrees did better than people with just a high school degree and all the way up the educational ladder. It has been tougher in recent years, but there are no statistics that disagree with the idea that you are, on average, better off with more of an education.
So for anybody who's listening to this program and is maybe gearing up to take the ACT, what's your biggest piece of advice you'd like them to take away?
For the ACT or any test, it's not something to cram for. The students who do best on it are students who have taken challenging courses and taken their work seriously throughout high school. You can do the most good if you're still 2 years away from taking it and you take rigorous courses and take them seriously.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for being with us.
Happy to be here. Take care. Bye.
Scott Jasek is an editor at Inside Higher Education.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at how the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program is working 1 year later. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
A year ago, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security set up the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, also known as DACA.
It allows some undocumented young adults who come to the U.S. as children to get work permits and also makes them eligible for things like internships or scholarships.
Roberto Gonzalez is an assistant professor of education at Harvard University. He's been doing research on how DACA has affected undocumented young adults, and he's here to talk about it.
Later in the hour, we'll also be talking to a student at Indiana University and recipient of DACA. And Roberto, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. What does it do?
Essentially, what it does is it provides a 2-year stay of deportation for undocumented individuals who came to the U.S. at young ages. And so these young people can apply for this Deferred Action program, receive a 2-year stay of deportation, apply for a work permit, and then also upon receipt, people can apply for Social Security numbers and, depending on where they live, driver's licenses, in-state tuition for college, and other benefits.
After those 2 years pass, can they apply again?
That's uncertain. This policy change is temporary and partial, and it's unclear what's going to happen in Congress as far as immigration reform goes. And so the future of DACA is also uncertain.
Well, why was this program set up in the first place?
Well, we've got this large and growing number of settled undocumented immigrants in this country at around 11.1 million. Of this broader population of undocumented immigrants, some 16 to 19% of them have been here since childhood. So what we have is a group, and really over the last 10 to 15 years, in large numbers, a group of young people born in countries outside of the U.S. without legal immigration status that are growing up, reaching adolescence and young adulthood without the ability to make good on their education, to be able to participate fully as Americans.
Now, we're still looking at a long and seemingly, you know, torturous path towards immigration reform in this country. But in the meantime, you've got some preliminary findings on how DACA has affected undocumented young adults. What have you found?
Yeah, that's right. Well, we launched a survey on July 1st, and in the 6 or 7 weeks since the beginning of our survey, almost 2,000 young people have taken the survey. Of those, a little over 1,400 have received DACA. And so from that 1,400, we're finding very strong evidence that DACA recipients are benefiting from increased access to the American dream. 61% of these young people have a new job. 61% now have driver's licenses. 54% have bank accounts. And 38% of them have obtained a credit card.
And these are things they wouldn't have been able to do without this program.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So really it's letting them mainstream into American society and become part of the functioning fabric.
Yes, and this certainly allows them in really important ways to make contributions, to be able to put their education to use, and to be able to help out their families and their communities.
Are there any downsides to how it's working?
Well, I think that, you know, there's certainly another side to this story. And over the last several years, what we've seen in immigrant communities across this country, these communities have experienced shrinking rights for non-citizens and increased enforcement efforts. Today, about 1,100 immigrants are deported each day. And so while many of these DACA recipients are certainly experiencing broadened access to the American dream, they're also really worried. They're worried about their futures. They're also worried about their friends and their family. So nearly one out of every two of those we surveyed reported worrying all of the time or most of the time that family members or friends will be deported. And nearly two-thirds of them know somebody a close relative or family member that's been deported.
Now, DACA is a part of what the DREAM Act aimed to do. What parts of the DREAM Act are still not being implemented?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the DACA is really, while it's temporary, it's also partial. And so certainly DACA recipients are able to apply for work permits and in some states receive driver's licenses and financial aid and other important points of access. But it's temporary, and DACA doesn't offer a pathway to legalization. And so you ask the question, what happens after 2 years? That's still a big question mark. It's a question mark for this country, and it's a question mark for these individuals. And so the major difference between DACA and a DREAM Act is that any of the iterations of DREAM Act proposals have included a pathway to legalization.
So you would expect that the same thing would happen with DACA as part of that act?
Yeah, that's right. I think that if Congress moves towards kind of a broader immigration package or considers something smaller for young people, that's what I think ideally for these young people and their families, that's the way to reconcile very untenable circumstances.
Now, given that you've got these findings and it seems as though DACA is working, 61% sounds like have a job, that people are getting driver's license and work permits and things like that. Is that evidence going to be taken into account as the country goes forward in general with immigration reform?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think that we certainly have, you know, these findings are preliminary and this study is ongoing. And by the end of the summer, that we hope to have surveyed 5,000 of these young people. And, you know, overwhelmingly, these young people, 94% of our respondents have said that if they are eligible for citizenship, they would apply. You know, whether or not our Congress and at this point it's really in the hands of the House, whether or not they're considering the evidence that is coming forward is still a big question. But I think that we now have, because of efforts like this, these data collection efforts like this, and some other researchers around the country have looked at the applications of the 500,000 plus DACA applicants, and we're really in much better shape than ever before from a data standpoint to be able to understand what is happening, who's applying, who's not, and certainly what is coming from increased access. And our study so far really points in a very positive direction to the notion that increased access is helping to improve lives, and that particularly among this population, those that are eligible and of age to be able to benefit from DACA, they're making immediate contributions.
Now, your study looked at some pretty solid tangibles there. You looked at jobs, you looked at credit cards, you looked at driver's license, but you also had that emotional aspect in there where it was revealed that these people were anxious about their families and there were some negative emotions going on as well. Why did you put that question in there?
Well, this DACA study is a follow-up to a 10-year project that I carried out in Los Angeles, and I had been following a group of undocumented young adults who came to the U.S. as children before the age of 12. And when I set out in the field to start interviewing these young adults, I had a set of sociological questions in mind, questions about educational attainment, questions about their job experience, about civic and political participation. And what I didn't expect to find, probably the biggest surprise of that study, is that almost to the person, the young people that I spoke to talked about their physical and emotional, mental manifestations of stress. So these young people talked about, they described chronic headaches, chronic toothaches, trouble sleeping, problems getting out of bed, eating problems, thoughts of suicide, attempted suicide. Mm.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. But Roberto Gonzalez, thank you so much for joining us and sharing the results of your study with us.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for covering this important issue.
We've been talking with Roberto Gonzalez, Assistant Professor of Education at Harvard University.
Coming up next, we'll check the latest news, and when we return, we'll be speaking with Fred Diego. He's a student at Indiana University and a recipient of DACA. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert with Cynthia Schuster.
Before the break, we spoke with Roberto Gonzalez, a professor at Harvard, who has been researching the effects of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program on undocumented young adults.
And joining us now is Fred Diego, who is a recipient of DACA. He's a student at Indiana University studying cognitive science and computer science. Fred, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Can you talk a little bit about what the process of being part of DACA has meant to you?
Well, it's mostly opening up opportunities that were previously unavailable to me. I was brought to this country when I was 3 years old by my parents, and they came here specifically because I'd have opportunities here that I didn't have in Mexico as a student primarily, and it's always been my goal to go to college, right? But when it came time to apply, there were obviously difficulties, as there are for all undocumented students, and I'm in college now, but internships were what would begin to matter. And DACA, its primary benefit to me has been allowing me to accept an internship, specifically this summer, at the Pittsburgh Science of Learning Center that I otherwise would not have been able to accept.
So what happens when you apply for an internship and you don't have DACA behind you as an undocumented student?
Well, for the most part, I believe most students without DACA would not even apply. Without a Social Security number, most internships are out of reach.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about your family background? You said you came with your family, I'm guessing, when you were three. What's happened since then with your family?
Well, both of my parents are undocumented to this day. So we entered without authorization, like a lot of families. And that means that although I have DACA now, they are still completely and utterly undocumented and still at risk of deportation.
So in the study we talked about, I don't know if you're listening earlier, but we were speaking with Roberto Gonzalez, who's a professor at Harvard, who's been looking at the effects of this program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, on undocumented young adults. And he was talking about some of the hardship. I mean, it's been a very successful program for people, including reasons like you yourself just named, but he also talked about anxiety that goes hand in hand with this. He talks about people reporting feelings of suicide, not wanting to get out of bed, having extreme anxiety and depression. What has your experience been with the downside of living in the United States as an undocumented individual?
Well, like I said, when I came here at the age of three, my mother gave up a career in Mexico. She was a nurse, and she spent a lot of time helping me pursue my education. She couldn't work in the United States because she's undocumented, so she spent a lot of time teaching me how to read and all the like. She bought me my first set of books. It was actually encyclopedias of the body, right? So my entire life I've been trying to go to college. Then I get to my senior year of high school, and that's when I first realized what being undocumented means. It means that I'm not eligible for financial aid, and that was my first bout of anxiety, thinking that the entire career I have been developing in my mind is out of reach. And, yeah, that induces a lot of anxiety. I managed to get into a college, and I have a scholarship. But even in college, I was a pre-med student, and that posed a lot of challenges for internships. So the fact that we are not allowed, as a community, we are not allowed to pursue our careers to the fullest extent of our capacities, I see how that can induce anxiety.
Had DACA not been implemented and been something that you could avail yourself of, what would the plan have been for you?
Could you repeat that question, please?
If you couldn't have been part of DACA, which would have enabled you to get internships and things like that, what would your plan have been going forward?
Well, I'm actually not entirely sure. Up until this point, I have always relied on the idea that I would one day gain some access to mainstream American culture so I could be a member of society. And without DACA, I would not be able to get even a career after I graduate from college. So I would have to create my path as I could along the way.
And do you think that being part of DACA has helped maybe the anxiety level of your whole family? Now you are in college. You have been able to accept internships, and I'm guessing you feel better about things.
Well, to a certain extent, and most of it is just the immediate things. I can drive now safely without worrying about being pulled over. I can work, which means that I can supplement a lot of needs. But in the long term, DACA doesn't really do that much. It's a two-year program that may end at any time, so the anxiety is still there. It's just been reduced.
Do you have you thought ahead to that? I mean, America, as you know, is looking at immigration reform. It's been a long, tangled road as politicians decide what to do. Have you thought, I don't know, a lot yourself about what your plans will be should different eventualities come into play?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, I entered without inspection, which leaves very, very few paths to citizenship for me. So my future without DACA is nebulous at best. And if we look back at what caused DACA to come about, it was youth organizing around, doing sit-ins all around the country in Obama campaign centers, right, re-election offices. So I believe that moving forward, I would like to form part of these movements that help move comprehensive immigration reform forward. But as of now, I have no direct path to citizenship, and many others like me are in the same situation.
Have you heard stories or had friends who came here as children like you did but ended up being deported?
I have a friend whose spouse was deported, and he left with her. He followed her to Mexico. And that's actually a very, very important question. DACA does very little for the students who are here. But what does it do for the students who have already been deported or whose families were deported and they were forced to follow? Or even those young children who are in the foster care system because their parents were deported? Or, for example, the Dream 9.
If you could have the ear of the House and the Senate and the President, what would you want them to know about your experience and what you'd like to see for immigration reform?
Well, I've spent my entire life cultivating a career in academia, and it would be a shame to allow a student with the passions and desires and the will to produce good for the society to not amount to the full capacity of its potential, right? And there are thousands of students all over the state of Indiana alone who are valedictorians, who are at the top of their class and have no access to higher education. And this is not only a great waste of human resources, but it's a detriment to American society in general. If I could say one thing, it would be I would ask them to closely inspect the individuals who they are so unfamiliar with, but yet so willing to deport.
To get to know the people they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Fred, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate you sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you.
That was Fred Diego. He's been a recipient of DACA, and he's a student now at Indiana University.
We'll check the headlines next, and then we'll talk to a nutritionist who will explain the science behind the afternoon slump and what we can do to stay energized throughout the day. This is Central Time.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time. And it's about that time in the afternoon when many of us start to get that urge to hit the vending machine or take a nap. Usually, neither of those things seems like a good idea.
And our next guest is here to help. She's Tracy Hittman Fountain, nutritionist and owner of Tracy Hittman Nutrition. And Tracy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's been called the 3 o'clock slump. Right now we're heading on to 5, but I'm sure the slump can extend to that whole pre-dinner time. What's going on in our bodies when we feel like we just need something to keep us going?
A lot of times people are just experiencing low blood sugar. So when your blood sugar goes low in your body's looking for energy. And when it's looking for energy, a lot of symptoms can be, hey, cravings for hitting that vending machine or just fatigue, like you want to take a nap.
What do we do when that happens?
Great question. We want to have that snack to get that energy going. But what a lot of people do, unfortunately, is they pick snacks that aren't going to give them a lot of long-term consistent energy. They're going to pick something out of that vending machine, like a bag of chips or that cookie that will give them that instant up. But guess what happens, an hour later, they're kind of crashing again. So then we hit the 5 o'clock crash right around now. So one of the best things you can do if you're grabbing a snack in the afternoon is try to really create a balanced, healthy snack. And one of the rules I use to determine whether it's healthy is it real food? Hasn't been around for 100 years. Did great-grandmother eat it? So things like, for example, a piece of string cheese and a piece of fruit. And when you create a balanced snack with having your protein with the cheese and then your carbohydrate with the fruit, that's going to give you more a sustained blood sugar response than having that quick up with that carb and then that crash where you don't feel good an hour later.
But I've got a snack actually that I was eating before you even came in. Yeah. This is a bag of brown rice cakes, which to me I thought sounded pretty virtuous, right? It's brown rice, which is supposed to be better for you than white rice. It's not sugary. I don't know. How does this rate?
Great question. It's not that that's an unhealthy choice, but what I would consider that is an unbalanced choice. Mm. Just like when we're reaching for those chips in the vending machine, rice is a carbohydrate that actually has a similar reaction in our bloodstream.
Even brown rice?
Even brown rice. Mm. It's still a starch. So, a simple solution to that would, just like I said, a string cheese, or maybe somebody would at least add some nut butter, which is a fat, which would help slow the release of that carbohydrate into your bloodstream. So it would stick with you a little bit longer. So not bad, but we just need to work on the balance part of it a little bit.
Cynthia had Sun Chips. How do those rate?
Cynthia.
I'm writing you out.
She throws you under the bus. again, kind of the same principle. Those things are real tempting because they're easy, convenient. They don't need refrigeration, but same kind of blood sugar response. And that's what I see with my clients across the board when we're grabbing those, what I'm going to call, carbohydrates, either complex or simple, they still really impact your blood sugar, give you that good up for, an hour or so, but then we're crashing and then we're hitting the vending machine again.
Well, what can we do maybe to prevent the slump in the first place in terms of our lunch meals or something?
Yeah, that's a great question because oftentimes people get to that point at 2 that they're starving because they didn't start their day out with balance or their lunch was out of balance. So I think one of the most important meals of the day, which we've all heard about before, is, you break your fast with breakfast. Breakfast is super important, but if we think about the typical American breakfast, again, it's a bunch of carbs, a bowl of cereal, which is carbohydrates, a glass of juice, which is carbohydrates. And then we put some milk on, which has a little bit of protein, but it's more carb. So people start their day with that blood sugar spike and crash. And then that leads to us having these cravings throughout the day. So I think, breakfast is important. Then if we carry that same idea with picking your protein first at lunch, then adding a carbohydrate, having a solid breakfast, that balance at lunch, then when you get to that 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, you're not jonesing for whatever the vending machine
Sun
is calling
chips,
at you. Sun chips, just for example.
So what's an example of a good solid lunch that you could eat?
Yeah, great question. I always think about picking my protein first, like I just mentioned. So depending on if you packed your lunch, it could look like from dinner the night before, say you had some grilled chicken or I have this great crock pot chicken recipe I love. So I'll bring my protein. Then I'm going to surround it with carbs that are great-grandmother carbs. Like I might have some, carrot sticks from the farmer's market right now. Some people might do a salad or a fruit combination. But really want to focus on picking that protein. So protein could be meat, it could be dairy, and it could be eggs. Could be an example of something that you could choose at lunch. And then just lining it on the outside with carbohydrates that have been around for a long, long time.
What about vegetarians? What can they do?
Yeah, it's a great question because vegetarians are going to get most of their protein sources from, beans and legumes, which actually still are high in carbohydrate, and nuts and seeds, which are actually more fat than protein. So making sure that they are, focusing on doing either eggs, some sort of dairy, or a combination of nuts and beans as their protein along with those healthy carbohydrates. I think a lot of us get into problems when we're eating a ton of starches and grains as our carbohydrates instead of focusing more on fruits and vegetables as carbs to match your proteins.
Well, when people are feeling sluggish, their tendency might be to dive for the caffeine. How does caffeine factor into that? Is that good or bad?
Yeah, caffeine's a question. I just was talking to a client today. She's like, what about caffeine? I'm like, how much are you drinking? That's always the first thing. I think caffeine in small amounts, when our energy is low, can actually has health benefits. Coffee in particular, high in magnesium. Caffeine can help stimulate metabolism when it's used in small amounts. When you use it in large amounts, that's when it stimulates your stress hormone system. That can cause some problems. So, you know, I say 1 to 2 cups a day. Preferably not on an empty stomach is a great way to use caffeine appropriately. And my clients always ask, how do I know if I have a problem? I said, well, if you don't drink coffee, what happens to you? If you turn into a bear or you have really bad headaches, that might be a sign that you're relying on coffee too much. And a lot of my clients, as they balance out their meals and snacks, they rely on that less for an energy source.
So if you have a really good lunch, like you were talking about, you've got your protein and you layer it with great grandmother foods, like you called it, grains or cheese or fruit salad. Do you still need the afternoon snack to get you through, or should your lunch carry you through if you're doing it right?
I think it really depends on the person whether or not lunch is going to carry them through. I find that most of my clients' blood sugar is so unstable that when they're first starting to work on balance, that they need to eat a breakfast, a snack, lunch, a snack, and then dinner. I call it the eating the house syndrome. So if you get home and you didn't have an afternoon snack and you cannot wait to get home and open your refrigerator and eat your whole house, that is a sign that you probably needed to have a snack. If you don't have to do that and are able to manage your hunger around dinner time, then you might be a person that can do well with just a solid balanced breakfast, lunch, dinner.
So we've already talked about my naughty snack today, but here's the other question, the other side of that. What is better? If we have no other choices at our fingertips, should we go for no snack or just take what we've got?
Ooh, that's a tough question. It's a good question. I think if you don't eat anything and you're going, let's say, 6-8 hours, and then you know the night is going to turn into something you're not going to be happy with in the morning, that having a little bit of an out of balance, not great snack, probably in that situation is better than nothing at all.
So there you go.
There you go.
You're vindicated.
Tomorrow will be a better day. But as I hear you talk about some of these good choices, preparing some fruits, vegetables, having maybe some cheese packed away, what I also hear is that it's going to take time, that we have to really plot out what we're going to bring into the office with us or take on the road with us. What tips do you have for either convenient snacks or carving out the time to prepare those good snacks?
Another great question. That old saying goes, you know, fail to plan to fail, I think is totally true in the situation with eating healthy. If you don't have a plan, the vending machine's going to look, you know, way too good. So what I have clients do is really try to either prepare in the morning for the day, pack simple things, which I'll give you some examples of in a second, or, you know, the night before, as they're cleaning up for dinner, you know, maybe they're packing some of those leftovers, getting them ready for work. And then a lot of my clients that have more like desk jobs, say, per se, they have stuff in their desk drawers that they can pull out. So for example, it's like you feel like a kid when you're doing it, but those to-go applesauce packs that you can kind of just like suck out of the package, they actually don't have any junk in them. I always have those in my office drawer with a clean beef stick that I get at the farmer's market. So that's my protein carbohydrate I always have available. So if I, you know, mess up my schedule, run out of time, I've got that ready to go. Some of my clients that can digest nuts and seeds will get it like a trail mix, you know, that has a little bit of fruit and nut mix, so that it's at least better than going to the vending machine and getting some chips. So that's something you always can have at your desk, you know, in a drawer, not have to worry about refrigeration. So it's planning ahead. I just really, or also cooking on Sundays. That's a huge help for my clients. You cook in bulk. So not just making one meal at a time, but preparing something on Sunday before the work week that you can divvy up into dishes and you're just grabbing stuff out of the refrigerator. So I'll peel all my carrots on Sunday. I'll chop them up, have them ready to go, have my fruit ready for the week. You can have the cheese sliced or the string cheese ready to roll so that you're not, as the week gets going, you're not like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do?
Yeah. Well, what about sleep? What role does that play? Because I've always heard that if you don't get enough sleep, you start to resemble, your body can get pre-diabetic levels if you're super sleep deprived. Well, how does that affect this blood sugar thing you're talking about?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because really when we're looking at blood sugar and fatigue and energy, it all has to do with stress in our body. So if our body's under a lot of stress, we're going to feel an increase in those things, fatigue, cravings, that sort of thing. And lack of sleep is a huge stress on the body. So, I mean, I can't quote the exact study, but I've read about sleep in the past. And the less amount of sleep you have, the more likely you are to be overweight. That just makes sense, because then you're too tired to make the good choices. And lack of sleep creates an increase in stress hormones, and that plays a big role in health and weight loss. So, you know, getting that 8 hours, I know as much as we hear eat breakfast and get 8 hours of sleep, it is really important for our overall health.
It's so hard to get 8 hours of sleep, though.
I know. I'm not saying that any of this is easy. That's the tricky part about it. But I always say, we look around and most of America is pretty sick and don't feel well. So if we want to be different than everybody else, we've got to start living different and making different choices.
So what factor or what role does getting outside and getting some exercise play in keeping our energy levels up?
Great. Another great question. You guys are just full of them today. I keep saying great question. One of the big things that can contribute to energy is enough vitamin D. So when we're getting outside, we're moving our body, we're exposing ourselves to sunlight. A lot of my clients in the winter notice a huge decrease in energy levels. And that has a lot to do, can be with vitamin D levels. And also the sun, again, just gives us energy. And then moving our body, I think, just helps remind us that, you know, we were meant to not sit behind desks all day and really, really, really get going. It helps us manage stress, too. I think it all comes back to stress a lot of times.
Should we supplement with vitamin D if we just don't get out into the sun enough?
I'm a proponent of getting your nutrition from your food first. But in our environment, most of my clients who are eating healthy because of our lack of sun exposure with our desk jobs and also with our winter climate need to supplement with vitamin D. So they're getting tested with their doctors. Their doctors are even saying, hey, your vitamin D is low. I'd say about 80% of my clients that are not supplementing have low vitamin D.
That is a lot.
It's a lot.
Is that a function of the way we live or a function of living in Wisconsin?
I think it's both. I think our environment and our weather and our climate plays a role in that overall number. But I think our lifestyles have changed to be more sedentary indoor, too. So both factors.
And what about our work schedules? Is there anything we can or should do to adjust our work schedules for it to be more conducive to healthier eating and snacking?
One of it's going back to sleep. So my clients that struggle the most are the people who have a schedule that's kind of all over the place. So as much as you can have a work schedule that's kind of consistent from week to week is really important. And then I think planning ahead and trying to make sure that you are, you know, cooking in bulk and doing some of these other things will help no matter what your work schedule looks like.
Well, Tracy, thank you so much. We've got some good stuff to work with now.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
All right, thanks. I'm going to have to do something with these rice cakes, some peanut butter or something. I'll top them with some sun chips. Maybe not. We've been talking with Tracy Hittman Fountain, owner of Tracy Hittman Nutrition.
Coming up, we'll explore the world of cryptozoology, the search for legendary animals. We'll find out why we want to believe in Bigfoot. That's coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.